From SDPB Radio, I'm Lori Walsh, your host of In the Moment, and welcome to the In the Moment podcast. This week, we talk with Jim Reese about his new book, Bone Chalk. We hear what shaped one of this year's South Dakota Hall of Fame inductees. We bring you poetry from Studio 47 by Patrick Hicks and Pete Folliard. We talk about what life as a tramper in South Dakota is really like, and we bring you a song sung by Sioux Falls artist Cade Thompson. But first, 22-year-old singer-songwriter Maria Hassel, who was originally from Sioux Falls, just debuted a new single called Anxiety. She says the song was inspired by her own journey, and she joined us to talk about that and her musical journey. Here's her debut single, Anxiety.
I've tried to scotch on the rocks to take the edge off, and I've prayed to Jesus. I've read every self-help book ever written, and I've meditated. Lit a cigarette to just let go, took a late night drive on cruise control. But my mind, it won't stop racing. My hands keep on shaking. When I'm tired, I can't sleep. And my heart beats twice your speed. And I can't shut it off or flip the switch. And I know that it's hard to get. It's nothing, and it's every little thing. Anxiety. I've got a therapist. She says it's in my brain, so I take my medicine, try to fix my DNA. I just keep on thinking it's gonna get better, but my mind, it won't stop racing. My hands keep on shaking. When I'm tired, I can't sleep. And my heart beats twice your speed. And I can't shut it off or flip the switch. And I know that it's hard to get. It's nothing, and it's every little thing. Anxiety. Cancel plans with no explanation. Overthink every conversation. Hold myself to too high expectations. I'm starting to think I might be going crazy. And my hands keep on shaking. When I'm tired, I can't sleep. And my heart beats twice your speed. Yeah, my mind, it won't stop racing. And my hands keep on shaking. When I'm tired, I can't sleep. And my heart beats twice your speed. And I can't shut it off or flip the switch. And I know that it's hard to get. It's nothing, and it's every little thing. Anxiety. On the rocks to take the edge off, and I've prayed to Jesus.
Jim Reese was with us earlier this week to talk about his forthcoming book, Bone Chalk. Now, Bone Chalk is a collection of essays that takes a look at the disparity between urban and rural America and what it means to live in the heartland. Here's Jim talking about crime and his work in the prison system and how that inspired one of the essays.
So now we're going to talk a little bit about crime and how it has really influenced your life, changed your life in ways that I didn't know until I read this manuscript for Bone Chalk, Jim, because you and I have talked before about your work teaching creative writing to prisoners in the federal prison system, the work you've done giving back. I did not know about the crime in your community, in your neighborhood growing up, about the death of your friend in high school. Let's talk about the man in Nebraska who abducts children and the fear that you kind of had as a little kid growing up of being that face on the milk carton.
Yeah, that's where the manuscript starts, you know. When I was proposing this book, one of the publishers I was very interested in it said, we might ask you for some more stuff. So I had a whole nother book, a rough draft of a book I was working on, which is the title of this essay, which was 12 Years in Prisons and what criminals teach me. So I ended up taking that manuscript, I think it might have been, 150 pages, and just condensing it down to what's in the book now, which is 34 pages, and changed it. You know, I kept looking for an answer. How are we going to solve problems for criminal justice? And it was very academic, and some of the editors and writers I was working with, specifically Kent Meyer, he's a great friend of mine and a great writer, very good editor as well, and he said, you know, you've got a great academic manuscript here, a great academic essay, but now why don't you change gears and really talk about how crime has affected you. And so that's what I did with this essay and just thought about that and then put that in a chronological order all the way up to now. You know, I just got done teaching a program for 2 years at the state prisons here in South Dakota at the women's prison and the men's prison, a writing program that we had there was about 2.5 years. But all this time I've also been teaching at the federal prison in Yankton. And part of that program, too, we did a lot of training for 4 years. We went to San Quentin back and forth to do some training and watch their arts programs. And so I started putting all that together and then really started at the beginning. So where did this start? What was going on in my life? And tried to put it in somewhat of a in order from the beginning. So if I start in Nebraska, it was 1984, serial killer, the Nebraska boy snatcher, John Jubert, was arrested. This is where I come from, urban middle America with apartment buildings and rows of split-level houses, manicured lawns and shopping malls. Never talk to strangers were four words constantly drilled into me and my friends because a lot of us were latchkey kids. We like to believe the neighbors looked out for us. When the serial killer John Jubert volunteered as a Boy Scout troop leader to lure and torture young boys, eventually kidnapping and killing two kids in the same part of Omaha where I lived, he became the nightmare, proof of the validity of those four words. None of us will ever forget the police crime sketch on milk cartons and plastered to street poles, this gruesome profile of a man with his mirrored sunglasses and hoodie pulled tight around his head. It was my neighborhood he did this in, and we wanted it back. To sleep most nights, I curled in a fetal position and stared at my bedroom window shades. It didn't matter what our parents said to console us. They were full of anger that this could happen in the Midwest, in the heartland. So we all reinvented worry. Never again would talk to strangers, because every one of them was him. We looked over our shoulders and learned to run the second an unfamiliar car stopped and someone inside asked for direction. It was the paranoia of the 80s in Omaha. And around the same time, I fell at the bus stop and stabbed an icicle into my knee. The school bus driver hollered, "Either board or I'm leaving." He left, and blood oozed as I limped back to the strip mall next to Country Club Village, the apartments where we lived. A guy came out of the office to help. Tried to reach my folks at work without luck, and then took me to school. Mr. Shiver practically yanked my arm out of the socket for catching a ride from a complete stranger, someone he didn't even know. That's when I knew my world had changed. These were the war zones of my home, which made us aware of our surroundings. After peace and love had fallen on the cusp of cocaine, and everyone began living faster and meaner, this was when you, John, were living with your nightmares, perhaps calculating rapes, cuttings, and killings. Ashes, ashes, John. No, no, no. That was our reality. And then high school started, and this is 1990, the murder of Christina O'Day. Christina had been babysitting overnight. Chris Garza and another perpetrator cut the phone line, broke in a basement window, tied her up, slit her wrists, took turns raping her, and then left her to die. For a few days after it happened, the police couldn't find him. His head shot on rerun on the news, the high school, the whole city of Omaha in an uproar. It was surreal, but it was our reality. In our high school hallways, I remember some of the friends Chris used to hang with before he dropped out, saying they knew where he was hiding. The gossip, the uneducated comments from some of those people in a class of over 450 was beyond disturbing and immature. The child Christina was babysitting is still alive. And the whole episode was replayed in the news 26 years later. Garza had been resentenced for the 1990 murder of Christina O'Day. He was given 96 to 110 years in prison. The judge factoring in good time law and time already served, Garza would be eligible for parole in about 23 years. And he is one of two men who beat, raped, and murdered Christina O'Day as she was babysitting. And at the age of 8, Beth Ann listened as the brutal crime unfolded. This is all from WOWT 6 News. Joe Chioda wrote this in the paper, and it said, 26 years after the murder, a Supreme Court decision means one of O'Day's killers, then 16-year-old Christopher Garza, is in line for resentencing. That based on a new research showing at the age of 6, a portion, or at that age, a portion of the juvenile's brain is not fully developed. WOWT 6 News spoke exclusively with Christina's mother, Sheila O'Day, following the sentencing. It's been hard to come to terms over the years, the anger, frustration, sorrow, but it's time to move on. I feel justice has been served. I wish I knew her. It's like your child left 26 years ago and you never saw them again. I believe she's at peace, but I still don't know her. I wish I could. I wish I could. And Beth Ann, now 34, returned from Georgia to attend the sentencing. She said it's a second chance at justice for O'Day. So when I think of this murder from my adolescence and of the safe split-level suburbia I came from, the fear is still ingrained in me. But what I know, after spending the last 12 years teaching in prisons, is that most prisoners aren't heinous animals. They aren't wicked criminals. And just to close this section of the essay off, it says, in an article, The Effects of Prison Education Programs on Recidivism, John Esperin notes, undoubtedly some individuals, murderers, rapists, child molesters, are either unwilling or unable to live and work as honest, hardworking brokers within the framework of society. These dangerous antisocial cases need to be kept in confinement permanently for the safety of the community. And obviously, I would agree with that. So I go back and look at this story from high school and talk about it. Christina was a friend of mine, and it really had a big impact on all of us, and it changed everything.
And there's this moment where you're invited as a teacher, as a professor with credentials, as an author, you can teach people how to write, and you're invited to come and teach some of these people who have committed crimes, maybe not murderers or rapists, but people in this federal prison system. You start on this path of working with criminals, working with prisons, working with the people who are going to be released, of which there are thousands every year who are released into communities across America. Do you have an awareness at that point that crime has touched your life in this way that's personal? I mean, not as much as some people, of course, but more than others. Are you looking for some? I mean, you knew the high school girl who died. Are you looking for something at this point to try to figure out who these people are?
I write about that at that point, because it's in a chronological order. Right after that happened, then my friend and I went to the same college together, and we both became criminal justice majors. This is 1991. Silence of the Lamb just came out too, so we're fascinated by this idea. Why do criminals do what they do? At least I was. And that major lasted for a year, and I switched my major multiple times. And in a roundabout way, in a big circle, here I am working in the criminal justice field, and also I'm a college professor teaching writing. And so it is something that always fascinated me because I wanted to know why did this happen, why did it happen? And I don't know if I'll ever have an answer for that specific crime, but then once I started working in prisons too, it took about 5 or 6 years for me to realize, hey, what are you doing here? It was cool the first couple of years to say, oh, I'm going to San Quentin. I'm a writer. I can say, I thought that was cool to tell people. I get to go to this you know, place you see on TV and this sensationalized place. And then, you know, I had a, it was just an ego. And then I started thinking, what are you really doing, Jim? What, why is this interesting to you? Set your ego aside. What's your purpose here? And then about 5 or 6 years into it, I realized, you know, wow, I can really, really help some people. And I started doing that, and it's my passion. You know, I think it's important. I think when I, one of the times I was at San Quentin too, I was reading, they have their own newspaper. It's 432 acres. It's this huge place. And it said, you can lock a person up and put them in jail, and that's all fine and good, and you can teach them a trade. But what you also have to do is you have to help that person come to terms with the emotional instabilities that brought them to prison in the first place. Because if you don't, then you're just going to send a pissed off person right back into society. So I think it's our obligation as a society. My job as a teacher, especially since I'm teaching in a prison, to try to help men and women come to terms with why they're there. And then hopefully they leave and never come back and are productive members of society.
Is opening that door for other people through the example of telling your own story and how that's done and the craft of it, but also through encouraging other people to pick up a pen and paper and start writing their way through some emotional, you know, gunk, some,
yeah.
How do you sort of help people with that emotional part of it? Because you've had to deal with this very specifically, college mm-hmm. kids write their papers to you and tell the page about horrific things that have happened mm-hmm. in their lives. Certainly you've seen that in the prisons, you've processed your own thing. What's your advice or recommendation? How do you walk people through that emotional task of telling the truth?
Yeah, I have a lot of really good prompts to get them started. I think the best thing as a teacher is you just have to create an environment where somebody feels safe to tell their story. Because it doesn't matter if I'm in a prison or in a college classroom at Mount Marty, there's no socioeconomic boundaries of what happens and where it happens, and if crime is there or bad things are happening, and people need oftentimes to tell their story to make some sense of it, you know? That's why I, in that essay, in the crime essay, I'm talking about Christina's murder, because I for a long time I tried to make sense of it, or anything, you know? It could be trying to understand these important people in my life and just being there and enjoying life. And so I think once you establish that environment, people are eager to tell their stories. There's a great book called Writing Poetry to Save Your Life by Maria Mazziotti Gillen. I would highly recommend that for everybody. There's over, I'm sure, 1,000 prompts in the back of that book that will help you get started. And I've just written down things that have worked. I remember being in Pittsburgh. I was doing a reading at Chatham University, and they've got this great program for the prison there, or the jail and prison, Allegheny County Jail. We went there, but they also do some stuff around town. And I asked one of the teachers there, I said, I'm going to be teaching at the women's prison in South Dakota. What's something, do I need to know something different, or do I just approach it the same way? And she said, you know, the first thing you do when you go in there, I'm going to tell you what to ask them. She said, here's the question. She said, ask them to finish this. No one ever asked me. And then let them write.
South Dakota is home to many species of fur-bearing animals. Trapping fur bearers not only serves as a recreational pastime in the state, it can be a valuable tool for wildlife management that allows sportsmen and women an opportunity to experience the outdoors. Mark Steck of Dakota Lion Snares shares insight into his life as a trapper in South Dakota. I'm very curious to know how you sort of got started in trapping and snaring. How old were you?
Well, I was probably 14, maybe 1971 or two. And it was a good way to make money. That was not my goal. There was just a lot of kids in the neighborhood in North Mankato that trapped. And so I was interested. I got hooked on it with a little bit of success off the bat. And I knew that I wanted to become better at it. There were a lot of fur buyers around. I mean, there was high demand for furs. And, And so I learned how to skin them and put them up, stretch them, dry them, and then you would take them to the fur buyer. And I always had money in my pocket back then.
Who taught you?
Well, one of my best friends, their family trapped muskrats, which is pretty basic trapping. And then on my paper route, there was an old guy. He was almost, I say old, but he was almost, I think he was 50 years older than me, almost to the day. His name was Patrick. And so one day I worked up the nerve to ask him if I could go along with him. I was always spying on him, checking out the back of his truck when I'd see it, you know, and because I knew he was a good mink trapper. Turned out he was just a very friendly guy, and back in those days, nobody would tell you anything. It was very secretive, and Pat and I became close friends, and so I learned a lot from him. And in fact, when I was a senior in high school, he had cancer, and I'd drive him to the Mayo Clinic. I'd skip school, and so he passed when I was a senior in high school. But he told me once, the very first time I went trapping with him, I skipped school. I was in the ninth grade. You know, he knew nobody would tell me anything. And he said to me, if you can't help somebody, what the hell good are you? Those were his exact words, and I never forgot those words.
So you went out with him. It wasn't just him giving you a tip or, you know, sharing a book with you. It was a hands-on experience together.
Yep, I'll never forget it. Yeah. And he was a very happy man, and he did cement work. But in the fall, he went trapping for mink and muskrats.
What was the appeal at 14? Clearly, skipping school seems like it was more fun for you than sitting in a classroom. But what was the draw?
It was a challenge. And I do recall an article in the Minneapolis Tribune about a guy that was out of high school, and he'd spend all fall and winter trapping. And I cut the article out. And I read it many times, and I thought, I want to do that. I want to trap and make my living trapping. But it was the challenge, and it was being close to the earth that I liked.
Yeah.
The idea for some people of running long trap lines is a romantic one. And I think that I was in that category of thinking that. But it's very hard work. And the harder you trap, the more work it is, of course. I lose weight during the trapping season. I've lost as much as 15 pounds during the trapping season. And it's very physical, but it's very rewarding, too.
Do you think about those original trappers, you've got gear now, warm weather gear, for example, that they didn't have in the early days of trapping in this region? Do you feel a connection to sort of the people who came before you, whether indigenous people or some of the early trappers that came to the area?
I don't know that I feel a connection, but I have high respect for what they endured because I don't walk that much anymore. I get close with these 4x4s and so forth. And these guys back in the day that were forging the ways out west, and the brutal winters, the high altitudes, and even handling their beavers, skinning them and putting them up. I don't know how they did it. All I know for sure is they were tough. And so I feel a brotherhood, but I feel more respect, and it's a different time now.
All right, let's talk about it changing. What is it like today versus what it was like trapping in your younger years?
Well, you know, anybody that hunts or traps that has any years behind them can go back to their spots and where they first trapped. And man has tamed the land more and more. I mean, creeks are straightened out and things change enormously. You know, the gas-powered engine has only been around 120 years or so. And so there's roads and there's equipment that can make land more tillable and so forth. And so a lot has changed. Also, what I do see changing is in South Dakota is you have a big city. Sioux Falls has changed so much. And that in itself, you can look at other states. Montana is a big one where there's a lot of out-of-staters that move there because of the mountains. And so trapping has faced from city dwellers and urban dwellers and people coming in from California and bringing their beliefs with them. It's faced pressure now in South Dakota, and there's constant pressure to eliminate trapping. And so that's something that we're seeing more and more. And it's not the landowners, it's not the small cities. It's these urban people moving into the Black Hills and Sioux Falls.
What is their opposition as you see it? What do you mostly hear? Are they concerned about just the killing itself? Are they concerned about the ecosystem? What are some of the arguments that you hear from some of those urban dwellers?
By and large, they do not want killing of any animals. And so trapping is the first target because we're a small fraternity compared to hunting. But they're after everything, right down to ranching. There is no limits with these people. And some are small groups, but they have connections. It's a never-ending pressure. And I don't know the future of how much they can change the world, but they aren't going to give up.
What do they not understand about trapping in South Dakota that you wish you could explain to them?
There's the primary thing they don't understand is that animals die, period. They die. Most animals don't make it through a winter. Nature is harsh. Mother Nature is very harsh. And they don't like, there's a couple things they don't like. They don't like the trappers harvesting these renewable resources, because it's appalling to them, an animal in a trap. What they don't see is I catch a lot of mangy coyotes in there. They're so cold and they're so fragile that they live in hay bales just to stay warm. They don't see how harsh Mother Nature is, and they don't understand that this is a renewable resource, in that we manage this resource. With man coming to the land, it has become so necessary for us to manage these resources, because man, in the way we live, has upset the balance in a big, big way. I trap for ranchers, and they don't like coyotes because they'll take cattle, calves, and in one case, a full-grown cow got stuck in the fence, and I got to witness this. And by morning, there was hardly anything left of it. There might have been up to a dozen coyotes that killed that thing alive and ate it and had the feeding frenzy. And to me, that's just nature. That's just nature. That's how cruel nature is. And it's not here and there. It's every day. Nature is very, very cruel. And compared to me harvesting critters in a professional and expert way, it's nothing. It's absolutely nothing in terms of suffering. When I trap, I have the utmost respect for critters, for the animals, whether it's coyotes or fox, beaver, whatever. I want them, for various reasons, I want them dead quickly, and I want their pelts in good shape. I need to check my traps on a regular basis. And so, yes, you can get trappers when prices are high that are unethical, but there's laws to keep them in place. And so other trappers normally take care of those trappers by working with game wardens. We work hard to protect what we have.
And now here's Patrick Hicks with this week's poetry from Studio 47.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Eleanor Wilner. Wilner was born in Cleveland, Ohio on July 29, 1937. She went to Goucher College, where she earned her BA in 1959. She then went to Johns Hopkins University, where she received her PhD. Wilner has been active in the civil rights movement, the peace movement, and much of her work focuses on what she calls cultural memory. That is, she avoids writing overtly personal poems and favors, instead, poems that speak about moments in our collective past. She often uses mythology and history to create her art. A former editor of American Poetry Review, she once described the poetic culture of North America as vibrant and wonderfully chaotic. More specifically, she said, "We are a chorus without a leader, and we pick up our themes and images from every side and from bristling at and listening to one another. It is this eclectic, imaginative miscegenation that makes our poetry so unclassifiable, so inexhaustible, and happily, so entirely unpredictable." Not surprisingly, she has written many books over her long career, including Gathering the Winds, Sarah's Choice, Otherwise, Reversing the Spell, The Girl with Bees in Her Hair, and Tourist in Hell, which focuses on the ferocious violence of the 20th and 21st centuries. Wilner has won a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Robert Frost Medal, as well as a fellowship from the MacArthur Foundation, often referred to as a genius grant. She has taught at the University of Chicago, Northwestern University, and she is currently a professor on the MFA program at Warren Wilson College. She lives in Philadelphia. Today's poem is High Noon at Los Alamos. Even though the title of the poem tells us that it's set in Los Alamos, New Mexico, the chronology of this poem goes back much further than that. In fact, we are brought back to the time of the dinosaurs, to those terrible lizards that once ruled the planet. Wilner wants us to consider that moment when a gigantic meteorite, perhaps one the size of a skyscraper, came roaring from the heavens in blinding fury. This flash of light, this fist of apocalyptic energy, obliterated forms of life that had existed on our planet for millions of years. When the shockwaves finally calmed and the smothering ash clouds rolled away, a new species, us, would eventually appear. In time, we would become the ruling species, which brings me back to the title of the poem. It takes place in Los Alamos. Why does that matter, you might ask? Well, Los Alamos is where the Americans invented the world's very first atomic bomb. It was here, under a program called the Manhattan Project, which was a government operation so secret that even Vice President Harry Truman didn't know about it, that scientists under the direction of Robert Oppenheimer unleashed fire in a way that they had never seen before. Wilner wants us to consider how we, as a species, yearn to capture fire, how we have used it for warfare, from the time of the Greeks until that time when two miniature suns were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Our quest for fire might very well be our undoing. Perhaps, Wilner suggests, fire will come from the sky once again to pare us down. This is High Noon at Los Alamos by Eleanor Wilner. To turn a stone with its white squirming underneath, to pry the disk from the sun's eclipse, white heat coiling in the blinded eye, to these malign necessities we come from the dim time of dinosaurs who crawled like breathing lava from the earth's cracked crust and swung their tiny heads above the lumbering tons of flesh, brains no bigger than a fist, clenched to resist the white flash in the sky the day the sun flares pared them down to relics for museums, turned glaciers back, seared cyanized meadows black, the ferns withered, the swamps were melted down to molten mud, the cells uncoupled, recombined, and madly multiplied, huge trees toppled to the ground, the slow life there abandoned hope, a caterpillar stiffened in the grass. Two apes, caught in the act of coupling, made a mutant child, who woke up to sunlight wondering, his mother torn by the huge new head that forced the narrow birth canal. As if compelled to repetition and to unearth again white fire at the heart of matter, fire we sought and fire we spoke, our thoughts, however elegant, were fire from first to last, like centuries set to watch at Argos for the signal fire, past peak to peak, from Troy to Nagasaki, triumphant echo of the burning city walls and prologue to the murders yet to come. We scanned the sky for that bright flash, our eyes stared white from watching, for the signal fire that ends the epic, a cursed line with its caesura, a pause to signal peace, or a rehearsal for the silence.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems used with permission, recorded at Augustana University, and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
The South Dakota Hall of Fame celebrates its 45th year. The honors ceremony is in Chamberlain, Oklahoma on September 13th and 14th. Tony Bohr is one of the new inductees, and he's founder and CEO of Showplace Wood Products in South Dakota. It's a national leader in the cabinet-making industry. We had the chance to sit down with Tony and talk about his early years growing up in South Dakota and how they shaped them into the man he is today. Tell us a little bit, because you have some interesting things from your childhood and your early years, because your first job was setting bowling pins in an alley.
Yes.
I'm dying to hear about that.
That was a long time ago, right. Obviously. And it was back before they had automatic pin setters. And I would hitchhike. I lived about 4 miles from the bowling alley. And I would hitchhike in the evening. And back then, most of my friends hitchhiked to get around. It was before we were old enough to have cars. And I would work weekends, Friday, Saturday night, and I made 10 cents a game for every game that was bowled on my alleys. And sometimes, most of the time, I would set 2 alleys at a time. But sometimes, if other people didn't show up to work, I would set 4 alleys.
All right. So logistically, what do you have, a little shelf that you're sitting? Where do you sit?
The back behind the pins.
Okay.
And there's a large cushion that the pins will bounce against, and then they'll fall into a pit. And then when the bowler is done bowling that frame, then you jump down into the pit and you pick the pins up. And I could pick up about 6 pins, 3 in each hand, and load them in the rack. And then I would hit a button or a cord, and the machine would put the pins down and spot them in the right place. So it was kind of a semi-automatic way to do it. But then between the 2 alleys, there was an open space, so I could go from 1 alley to the next and stand in there.
And nobody can really see you from, they're just going to see your hands or whatever?
Like, no,
the
they
bowlers
could, they,
aren't going to see you.
They really couldn't, no. The lights shine on the pins and they shine on the alley, but they don't shine on the pin spotters.
How many hours at a time were you doing this as
a
kid?
Probably an evening, maybe 5-6
wow.
hours.
That's yes. a lot of work for a... Yeah, for
and a good night would be maybe $10.
Yeah. Wow.
But at 10 cents a game, and you would have maybe 4 or 5 people bowling on an alley at a time. So you could have 10 people bowling at the same time.
That's remarkable.
And it was a great experience.
Yeah, how things have changed, right?
Oh, my.
Tell me how you got into making and building, and what sort of, was there someone in your family that kind of taught you about cabinetry? How do you get into sort of that craftsmanship?
Well, actually, my maternal grandfather was a cabinet maker, but he was a lot older than I was when he was doing his trade. So I can barely remember what he did. And back then, of course, they didn't have the equipment that we have today. But that was his business. And then I was living in St. Paul with my folk, St. Paul, Minnesota. That's where I was born. And then as I was starting to move into school and that, my grandparents moved to St. Louis. And in the meantime, he retired from making cabinets. So I really didn't inherit the business from him. Perhaps sawdust in my veins, but that was about it. My dad was a World War II pilot. He flew bombers over in World War II. He flew over the Himalaya Mountains, and he retired as a bird colonel back then it was the Army Air Force. But when he came back from the war, and back then they didn't know a lot about PTSD, but he suffered from PTSD, and back then, what they did to attempt to cure it was shock treatment, and it was horrible for him. And he went through that for several months and then retired from the Army Air Force. And then he went to work as an industrial arts teacher at a boys' reform school. Hmm. And we lived across the street from this reform school. So Dad could walk to work. What I learned from that experience is that a lot of the problems with the young men and probably today can be attributed to automobiles. And my dad would not let me have a car until I was starting to be a young adult. I never drove his car until I was married. And I learned to drive because friends worked with me to learn to drive. And then because of my job at the bowling alley, I saved money and I eventually bought an old car.
Wow.
So that was my start. But my dad was very, very rigid.
Yeah.
And it was good. I learned a lot from him.
Kay Thompson started his journey into music taking piano, guitar, and drum lessons as a youngster. After joining the youth worship team in sixth grade, a music mentor came into his life who emphasized the importance of seeking God through the Bible outside of a worship setting. In his early teen years, Cade says he knew God was calling him into music ministry, giving him opportunities to grow into that calling. Cade released his first single when he wrote and recorded at 14 years old. That was called Faithful and True. Well, we welcomed Cade Thompson into the studio Friday, where he played us some new tunes. Here's one.
Heard it, you feel broken inside, your heart is empty from the joy they denied. You pour out mercy, but it's never returned. The pages turn it, and your tears are the words. And it seems the sun won't rise, yeah. But I promise you tonight, a new morning is coming, just hold on. Let love keep shining, it's almost dawn. Can't you see the light breaking, changing everything? Hold on, it's almost dawn. You've been wounded by the ones you hold close. Their words affirm you more than they'll ever know. But keep on trying, you're never fighting alone. May grace define you, hope will guide you home. And it seems the sun won't rise, yeah. But I promise you tonight, a new morning is coming, just hold on. Let love keep shining, it's almost dawn. Can't you see the light breaking, changing everything? Because you're more loved and wanted than you could dream. You make more of a difference than it may seem. Can't you see the light breaking, changing everything? Yeah, can't you see the light breaking, changing everything? All will be healed, all will be well. Just hold on a little bit longer, 'cause you were seen and you were loved. The story is far from over. A new morning is coming, just hold on. Let love keep shining, it's almost dawn. Can't you see the light breaking, changing everything? Yeah, because you're more loved and wanted than you could dream. You make more of a difference than it may seem. Can't you see the light breaking, changing everything? Yeah, can't you you see the light breaking, changing everything? Hold on, it's almost dawn.
Are you looking for an individual segment from our radio program? You can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcast is produced by Josh Heyer. Follow us on Instagram at @SDPBInTheMoment and Twitter at @MomentSDPB. Have a story idea? Send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Josh Heyer, Chris Loffrey, and Steve Zwemke, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.